WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Friday. Time for us to take a look back on the biggest recent stories in the Chicago area and in Illinois in our weekly news recap. And what a week it was. Governor J.B. Pritzker delivered his annual budget address.
Governor J.B. Pritzker's sixth State of the State address calls for some new tax increases.
Mayor Brandon Johnson announced his plans for economic development in the city.
We're going to invest. It's going to be incremental.
Mayor Brandon Johnson is talking about a plan to borrow $1.25 billion to invest in neighborhoods.
And going forward, no more cops in schools in Chicago.
Chicago's Board of Education passes a resolution directing Chicago Public Schools to end its use of school resource officers.
To discuss those stories and more, we put together a great panel on the recap this week. Brandis Friedman is co-anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Dave McKinney is a WBEZ state politics reporter, and Justin Lawrence, a Reset Recap newbie, is a government and politics reporter at Crane Chicago Business. I started by asking him to explain Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson's plans for economic development, which were unveiled Wednesday. Here's Justin.
The top line details on this, it would be a $1.25 billion bond plan to fund $250 million annually over 5 years in sort of economic development and affordable housing investments. And kind of what's interesting and what's key here is this is a kind of a marked shift in how the city's traditionally funded this. The city has relied on an ever-growing kind of TIF districts across the city. These have been criticized for kind of giving the mayor, Mayor Daley, Emmanuel Lightfoot, now Johnson, kind of a piggy bank that they can shift around and move into projects.
And by TIFs, we mean tax increment financing.
Yes. These are a bit limited because that money that comes into those TIF districts can only be spent within TIF districts. It can't be spent elsewhere. And kind of the issue with TIFs is the ones that bring in the most money are in the areas that probably least need an injection of city dollars to kind of spur investment there.
Yeah. Right?
So the argument for this bond plan is, hey, we open ourselves up. We can spend this money all over the city, not just within TIF districts, and we can do more with it. We can kind of directly build affordable housing. We can do an interesting program. I'm not sure the name they've given it yet, but like provide low interest construction loans to private developers who would then build affordable housing and then, sell it back to the city, and the city would maintain it. Other cities do this. It would be an interesting and new sort of way for the city to create affordable housing.
And you touched on this, but help us understand the controversy surrounding these TIFs.
Yeah. So when a TIF is created, they kind of set the property value within the TIF district at a set level. And then as the years go on and that value rises, all of the incremental value then goes into this TIF bank and is used on infrastructure projects and community development grants, sometimes goes to parks and schools. But those TIF districts, that money is then being captured by the TIF district, and it's not flowing to where it would normally flow. Chicago Public Schools, libraries, parks, the city itself, Cook County. So it's kind of been criticized for taking away. It's I think, more complicated than that, right?
Yeah.
But it's always been something that's been in the news, and people have been pretty frustrated when they get created.
Absolutely. Well, Dave, is this $1.25 billion plan another sign that Johnson's fully committed to the progressive agenda that we've known him to run on?
Well, I think it is. I mean, in his campaign, you know, he was all about neighborhoods, neighborhoods, neighborhoods. And so this is being pitched as a way to go back into the neighborhoods and bring resources there. I think the one question you have, though, is like, where's the list of projects? What exactly is this going to fund? Because, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money. And the whole principle behind general obligation bonds, which is what this would be, is that whatever you're spending that on, you hope that you still have that resource functioning and in place by the time these bonds are paid off.
Yeah.
And as opposed to just sort of like a candy, you know, sugar high on the front end of the borrowing. So, I mean, that's kind of the important part of the finance piece of this equation. You know, it can't be pork projects. It's got to have some legitimate use. And I think, you know, from everything that I've pieced together on this, that's a question within the city council some older persons have. It's like, show us where this is going to go.
Yeah. What's the likelihood then, Justin, of Alders actually approving this plan?
So this is a project that the mayor, he's kind of put on a fast track, right? They introduced it at city council this week in February. He's said he wants it approved in March, which is a pretty quick turnaround for such a large project. To be honest, I do think that it seems pretty likely that it will be approved. I think people will have questions about it and they want to learn more details. And specifically, aldermen all across the city are going to say, how do I sell this to my community? And yeah. I would want to sell it to my community by saying, hey, here's what we're getting out of this. Here's what Brighton Park's getting out of this, Rogers Park. So I think there will be a lot of questions, but kind of the key to this is that, again, it can be spent throughout the city. And a lot of aldermen have been blocked out from using or kind of benefiting from TIF because they don't have TIF districts in their wards. So I do think it will be approved probably pretty easily, but there will be a lot of questions over the next month.
Yeah. Brandis, let's turn to some other city council developments. Alders overwhelmingly voted to create restrictions on the opening of new dollar stores. What are the details?
Yeah, so aldermen voted 42-7 to crack down on dollar stores. And so the new rules are there's a ban on new dollar stores or stores that have where the items are sold at a value of like $5 or less. Can't open within a mile of each other. And they also have to have signage posted with a phone number where people who are customers, residents, whatever, that they can call basically to register complaints. Because the problem has been from a number of aldermen, there is a concentration of these stores on the south and west sides, and they are falling into disrepair, right? They are overrun with trash, and we all know that trash attracts mice, or they are selling food that is expired. You know, on the flip side of this, though, there are some folks who say that these so-called small box stores are filling a void that the big box stores left when they left.
Yeah, let's hear what 19th Ward Alderman Matt O'Shea had to say on that.
Drive past any one of those 149 stores today, and you'll likely see overflowing dumpsters, broken fences, broken exterior lights, buildings in disrepair, shopping carts overturned on the sidewalk or in the parking lot. Yet it's funny, when I drive just 5 or 10 minutes outside my community in a predominantly white suburb, I don't see that.
So, Justin, Brandis brought this up. You know, the alderman saying here, the stores in his southwest side ward, they're an eyesore. But we also know that they serve a budget-friendly purpose for some residents, right?
Right, and that's what the dollar stores started to make the case of when they pushed back against this. And they also said, hey, look, you've kind of awakened us. We're aware now of how big an issue this is. I think the alderman would say, we've been making you aware of this for years and years, and you've been fined, and it hasn't changed anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now that you're going to pass this ordinance, we're aware, we will fix it. Don't prevent us from opening it and kind of expanding. That argument didn't really pass muster. You know, this was something that got delayed. It was supposed to be voted on in January, and it seemed that this pushback was really growing, and I thought it might be more controversial to even get delayed again, but it ultimately passed 42-7.
Yeah.
There wasn't much opposition to it once it finally got to a vote. Something to look at going forward, you know, there's kind of been hints that this might be litigated, that they might bring a lawsuit. Kind of specifically the way the ordinance is written is it blocks ownership groups from locating within that distance to each other, and not rather the use of a dollar store or that kind of zoning use. Mm-hmm. So there might be some merit there to a lawsuit. The city would not comment, obviously, on the potential for litigation, but that's kind of the next step here.
Brandis, the Chicago Board of Education also made headlines yesterday. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, so they agreed. I think it was, I'm not sure if it was a resolution or what the specific measure it was they passed. But basically, they have decided to remove school resource officers from the schools in the Chicago public schools that still use them.
So no more cops in schools.
No more cops in schools. And we know that this is something that students really began advocating for in 2020, when a lot of society began to kind of reconsider the way we're doing things. And are we being equitable? And what's the impact on Black and brown students? And so basically the school district has to come up with a plan by its June board meeting for the removal of police officers in schools by the start of next school year. Keep in mind, they are only at high schools, and I believe there's a double digit number of schools that are 39 out of 634 district schools are still using SROs.
Okay, so they were already being phased out.
They were already being phased out. It started a couple of years ago, where it was left to the LSCs, the local school councils, to begin making that decision on whether or not, and some of those LSCs began scaling back.
The mayor and city council also weighed in on several issues concerning the police over the last week. I want to start with the confusion over the ShotSpotter contract. Last Friday, the recap panel and I were debating whether or not ShotSpotter would be turned off that very same day. Well, it turns out this week we learned the city will spend $8.6 million to extend the contract for 9 months. That is a bit more than what the city paid for this service for all of last year. Brandis, can you make sense of this?
No, well, here's my speculation.
All right.
Well, because when the city announced that they were going to end this contract and it would be phased out by, you know, this short-term extension, I don't think ShotSpotter, run by the company SoundThinking, I don't think that they had agreed to that deal at the time. And so I think when everybody gets behind closed doors and then they start to work out that deal, SoundThinking is going to make it worth their while to have that extension. I think it's also a blow to them, right? Even when the mayor, who campaigned on getting rid of ShotSpotter,
yeah,
you probably covered this last week, even when he said that he was going to cancel this contract, their stock fell.
Yeah, well, I mean, while we're on, going back down memory lane, talk about the controversy here, Brandis. What are we hearing on both sides about this gunshot detection technology?
So you hear from law enforcement, and we know that CPD Superintendent Snelling has said that this is an important part of the crime-fighting tool, right? Like, the city has invested in a large number of these strategic decision support centers around the city that include ShotSpotter, along with some other technology that can identify where a gunshot is coming from. Law enforcement says it allows them to deploy an officer much more quickly. And sometimes there are shots that are picked up on ShotSpotter that no one dialed 911 for. Mm-hmm. So they're saying it allows them to respond more quickly. And I think there was even the argument that they act as sort of a deterrent, right? That, like, if it's keeping shots from being fired, right? Because people know that it exists
by
this technology.
But it's being criticized.
It is being criticized heavily, especially because these are mostly in, you know, Black and brown, south side, west side neighborhoods. And there's the argument that it contributes to the over-policing of these neighborhoods.
And it doesn't always work. It's ineffective. Sometimes it's picking up fireworks.
And it doesn't always work. There have been multiple reports that it's missing shots or that it's misidentifying shots.
Yeah. In other police-related news, Justin, we talked about this one last week, too. City Council rejected an arbitrator's ruling allowing the most serious police disciplinary hearings to be heard in private. Now, this week, the police union showed that it's not going down without a fight.
Yeah, and this is another thing at City Hall that's been percolating for months. They've had a series of votes on this. So the entire time, John Cotanzar, who's the president of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police, mm-hmm. you know, they are the largest police union, mostly representing rank-and-file soldiers. And at these meetings, he has been, I've been writing taunting City Council and the mayor, you know, as they're taking these votes.
Mm. What does that look like exactly?
It looks like him standing up behind the alderman and shouting things like, you know, open up your wallets, because they're going to take the city to court. They've said if the city, and remember what the city did, they rejected an arbitrator's ruling that would upend kind of the police discipline process. So now the FOP, they originally sued and won a temporary restraining order from allowing the Chicago Police Board from hearing these sorts of kind of harsh discipline, up to a year suspension, up to termination, cases from being heard. And now they are seeking kind of the final judgment here, right? A summary judgment to kind of end this process, at least in the first court's level, the city could always appeal and force the city, even though the city council rejected it, mm-hmm. even though the mayor wanted them to reject it, to force the city to adopt the arbitration ruling kind of over their objections.
Yeah. Well, I want to stick with you for just another moment, Justin, for another headline out of city council. We know that things can get heated, as you sort of just described, but one alderman's being accused of really taking it to the next level. Catch us up on that drama with Alders Greg Mitchell and Desmond Yancey.
Yeah, and so these are neighbors, along the South Shore.
The 5th and 7th Ward.
5th and 7th Ward. And Alderman Desmond Yancey had introduced, sometime back in the fall, kind of an affordable housing, a preservation ordinance that would affect South Shore, both wards, right, that both of them represent. Greg Mitchell has been opposed to this, apparently. They've had some conversations previous to this that were pretty heated. But on, not this past week, but 2 weeks ago, they had a city council meeting. And Greg Mitchell kind of approached them about this. Desmond Yancey says, kind of out of the blue, they grappled. He kind of wrapped his arms around his head and shoulders. Yancey says it felt like he was doing that in an attempt to drag him to the floor.
Yeah, Yancey claimed he was, quote, the victim of an unprovoked assault.
Yes.
By Mitchell.
And that kind of language, that was in an email to all of his colleagues and the mayor, saying that this happened and I think Mitchell should step down from his leadership role as he's the chair of the Transportation Committee, he's the vice chair of the Black Caucus.
Well, they're saying it's also not the first accusation against him.
Right. We should say here that Mitchell has blanketly denied any sort of physical assault.
Okay.
But he, a couple months ago at City Hall, there was someone it was on the first floor, was filming Greg Mitchell in a way, and he didn't like that, and he kind of grabbed the phone out of the guy's hands. And then recently someone in in the 7th Ward who's been sheltering migrants kind of is at his own cost. He's a landlord. He claims, allegedly, that, you know, Greg Mitchell threatened him and was very aggressive in telling him that he doesn't like what he's doing and you hear from him. So, you know, we don't have a resolution to this yet. The Black Caucus met after the city council meeting on Wednesday to discuss this. Both of these aldermen are Black. They're both members of the Black Caucus. And the mayor said he would speak to both of them over the next 36 hours, which is about right now.
I
think so. Maybe we'll hear more about this if he's actually going to lose his spots. But
what does this remind me of? Grade school.
It is.
Reason,
I mean,
right?
It is.
Yes. Principal's office.
Mm-hmm. You're in trouble.
Yeah. Dave, looking at you before we take a quick pause here for an update on what's happening with aid and services for migrants. I'm hearing the city recently closed 4 shelters.
That's right. In the Loop, North Lawndale, Lakeview, and North Park. And that's basically a result of a lull in migrants coming into the city. I mean, January and February are traditionally kind of the low period of time when there's migration across the border. The numbers, 42% drop in Venezuelans crossing the southern border right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the other data points here that are kind of interesting, a little over 12,400 migrants currently being sheltered in the city right now, and that's the lowest since November. So that's all kind of coming together to reduce demand for these. Now, of course, some of them are positioned to reopen if the need arises. And certainly, you know, I think the whole city is kind of on guard for what happens with the Democratic Convention. You know, what kind of spectacles do we see coming from, you know, perhaps, you know, potential enemies of the Democratic Party in the city of Chicago.
We are exactly 6 months away.
That's right.
Now, Governor Pritzker unveiled a nearly $53 billion budget this week, Dave. Took nearly 52 minutes to unveil that budget. Walk us through a few of his big budget plans and who some of the big winners are.
Yeah, you and I were together in the studio going over that on Wednesday. Well, I mean, this was a budget that was billed as a rather austere budget compared to some of the other ones he's had, because there's been, you know, this influx of income tax and sales tax revenues plus federal help, and a lot of that is sort of slowing down right now. And so they've been kind of tapping the brakes a little bit. This is not a budget where we saw a lot of cuts necessarily, but it was one where he, you know, continued, as we talked about Johnson earlier in the show, funding his priorities, kind of reaching, you know, going after his base, money that went to early childhood programs. That was a big area, about $400 million there. Mm-hmm. $250 million toward homelessness. $500 million toward continuing to build Illinois as a quantum computing hub, which is a big priority of the governor. He's kind of I'm going to say a computer geek, but he's much more than that when it comes to, you know, his interest in trying to develop that technology in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Smaller things that I think have a broad swath. I mean, there was an initiative that it's back prior to July as part of a package that the legislature passed to help people contend with inflation. They suspended the 1% state tax on groceries.
Yes.
And so this is something that it sunsetted in July.
Yeah.
And Pritzker is saying, well, let's make that permanent. Let's get rid of that. And it's, you know, not a big thing for people. I mean, most people probably will forget about it after a certain point in time. But in his speech, he said, you know, it might save a few $100s.
He made it a big moment.
Yeah, for sure. He wanted people to know about it.
He thought it was 10%.
So, I mean, that's kind of the broad swath of it. I mean, you know, there are other bits and pieces of it where he talks about, you know, trying to get the pension systems in line. And you know, that part of it was really, I think, kind of another outreach to the bond rating agencies because, you know, he has touted repeatedly how the state on his watch has had like 9 bond ratings. Upgrades and our finances have become more stable under his watch. So that was a bit of another flavor of that speech.
Brandis, anything stand out to you in the governor's address?
Some of the stuff that Dave already mentioned, I was, you know, sort of watching and curious about education and how that would be funded.
Right.
Just because I remember when the equity-based or the equitable funding formula was passed under Rauner years ago, 2017, I think it was. That was a big production. That was a big fight. And obviously it only works, or the, you know, experts say it only works if you continue to put in the funding every year. And it looks like he's only putting in the $350 million that is already required because I think at the time it took like $1 billion. And so the state would have to put in hundreds of millions each year in order to keep it going. And so it looks like he's doing that. I was also curious about, what he would say with regards to early childhood. It included, what, $13 million for a new state agency that he has already announced about early childhood education. So he's creating a whole new agency there. So those were the things I was kind of looking for and curious about what the plan was for those. Because I know, obviously, early childhood has always been something for him. So
what were you keeping an eye on Wednesday, Justin?
Yeah, two things stood out to me, and I'm looking at Dave to keep me honest on the facts and figures here. But that increase on sports betting, right, it would more than double it, go from 10 to 35%. That's a very large increase year over year. I believe the governor said it would bring in another $200 million annually. But, I mean, that's a very fast-growing industry. I mostly focus on the city. The city only has a 2% tax on sports betting. So my first thought was maybe the city is seeing that and saying, oh, maybe we should go up a little higher. But so that stood out. And then the other, I mean, it's kind of a small investment, but it would have been a big impact, is this $10 million to wipe out potentially $1 billion in state residents' medical debt.
Yes.
That's a similar, the Cook County has had a similar program. Cook County, I believe, was using federal COVID relief dollars to do this, and it's a program that's really won plaudits. It's kind of just a direct, we will buy up your debt and wipe it out, and it's kind of a direct benefit to people who are struggling.
Yeah. Brandis Pritzker committed $50 million to, quote, attack the root causes of housing insecurity for Black Illinoisans. Any details on this?
That's for the funding for the Home Illinois program, which addresses prevention response to homelessness, expanding housing support, creating job opportunities. I think he also talked about, services to young adults, those who are aging out of the foster care system, who have higher rates of going on to become homeless. Obviously, folks, you know, I just ran a story about this yesterday, about the evicted exhibit and how the relationship between, you know, you miss that rent payment or you miss enough of them, you're evicted before you know it, you're unhoused.
And so
addressing that, because we also know that Black people are disproportionately impacted by homelessness.
Governor Pritzker is also gearing up to fight with the powerful insurance industry, demanding major reforms. What did the governor say there, Dave?
Sasha, he's calling it the Healthcare Consumer Access and Protection Act, and it's got, you know, several prongs to it. One would ban what he called junk insurance plans that really You know, I'm not even sure I understand what the point of it is, other than taking people's money, because as I understand it, some of these plans don't even offer the base things that are guaranteed under the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to, there, I think about a dozen states have attacked those types of plans that are out in circulation. There's another piece of it that would go after insurance companies requiring prior authorization for things like mental health services.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, I had a colleague in the newsroom here the other day tell me a little bit about her experience. She has eczema, and she went to the doctor to get treatment for it. And the doctor said, hey, I hate to do this to you, but it's a situation where I've got to prescribe this stuff that probably won't work, but the insurance company says I've got to do it.
Wow.
And then once that fails, we'll give you the stuff that works. And so that practice is something that's being targeted under this plan as well.
And Justin mentioned that the governor's budget includes, you know, the spending millions to really wipe out some of that $1 billion in private medical debt for low-income families. How is he proposing to pay for all this?
Well, I mean, there's a very short or very small outlay that the state actually has to make a huge difference. Because, you know, basically what we're talking about, this would help roughly 300, 350,000 low-income folks who have, you know, this massive debt that they've accumulated and can't pay for. And what this would do is acquire the debt. It would help. It would go through a nonprofit, but it would help acquire this medical debt, and then it's negotiated down basically, and so it goes away. And so this is an effective technique to help, you know, basically improve the lives of people who are on the lower strata of the ladder.
All right. The governor also addressed the migrant crisis during Wednesday's State of the State address. Let's listen.
I will not join the chorus of people in this country, or in this chamber, who eagerly looked to slam shut an immigration door that was once open to our ancestors.
So, Dave, what did he actually commit to doing to address the needs of migrants?
Well, I mean, this is something that he's said he negotiated with Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle and Mayor Johnson. He's committing $182 million in state resources to help attack this, and, you know, that would go toward helping you know, with the shelters, the welcoming centers, and the wraparound services that go along with that. And that would bring the state's commitment, if that's approved, to $820 million, which is a huge chunk of money that nobody, you know, a year or two ago was even contemplating.
Right.
And so that's that. But, I mean, what I've been told kind of repeatedly is this commitment of $182 million, of course, it's got to go now through the meat grinder of the legislature, and it may be whittled down. But I think there is a question about, you know, the city's commitment. Is Mayor Johnson on board with his share of, you know, committing resources to this? If that's not the case, I think you could see resistance in the legislature to approving $182 million.
Let's hear what Senate Republican leader John Curran had to say about the governor's plan.
Governor Pritzker just proposed raising taxes on Illinois families and businesses by more than $1 billion to pay for the migrant crisis he created. Governor Pritzker has systematically used Illinois tax dollars to create a non-citizen welfare state here in Illinois.
I bet this is how most Republicans reacted, Dave.
It is. And they're trying to use this as a wedge issue for the fall. Of course, all the legislative, you know, elections are in play, and they're hoping to make some gains with that.
Yeah.
So this is a topic.
Yeah, and a good point Dave touched on, Justin. I mean, it's interesting that as the governor, as well as Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, as they're pledging these millions for migrants, Mayor Johnson was unwilling to commit to spend more money.
Yeah, they had been meeting, you know, the staffs of these three entities have been meeting for weeks, maybe months, to come up to kind of try to finally get ahead of this issue, right? We're always reactive and finding new money and kind of in emergency mode. And they were trying to get ahead of it and identify what is needed through the rest of the year to sustain this kind of mission. And they identified $321 million, according to the state and county. And, you know, the state and county stepped in with their portion. The state would do 50%, county and city 25% each. And at least the state and county walked out of a meeting with the three of them a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And believed that the mayor had committed to at least going to the city council and trying to get another $71 million. The mayor's office says he never made that commitment. He was asked about this on Wednesday after the governor's speech, and he kind of didn't really say either way again, and said we're looking to a holistic approach to this mission, and my commitment's still there. But I think as Dave said, like, what they really committed to was going to their respective legislative bodies and seeking this money. And it's going to be hard for the governor to do this if the city isn't stepping up as well, or at least there will be more resistance to kind of the state funding so much if the city's not going to put in a little more.
Yeah. And so, Brandis, a couple of things here. Pritzker scolded Illinois' Republican congressman for cowering to Donald Trump and voting against federal immigration reform. It really made a point of standing up to Trump as well as Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Republicans in his speech. On the other hand, it was very interesting to watch Pritzker defend Joe Biden in yesterday's address. So I'm curious if it seems to you that he's clearly gearing up to quarterback August's Democratic convention.
Yeah. It does seem clear to me, doesn't it? He got a little bit salty yesterday, and he actually equated, you know, something, anything, you know, vernacular that President Trump might drop to something that might be said at a Klan rally. But, you know, he says the Democrats and President Biden negotiated an immigration bill. Bipartisan, along with some Republicans. Yet when it was go time, the Republicans are like, "Oh, sorry, I'm not actually voting for that because President Trump said not to do that, and because President Trump has said that he wants this to be the downfall of President Biden come November."
One particular Illinois politician really feeling the wrath of Donald Trump right now is former gubernatorial candidate Darren Bailey. What happened, Dave?
Well, I mean, that was that is like upsetting the apple cart in a way that, you know, Darren Bailey must be shell-shocked. Of course, he was the gubernatorial candidate that J.B. Pritzker beat.
Oh, we remember.
We remember it well. And Darren Bailey had made, you know, he had gone to Mar-a-Lago, had his picture taken with Trump. He had a fundraiser kind of in the middle of his former district with Donald Trump Jr. And so he was just doing everything he could to curry favor with Trump. And that district, the congressional district that Mike Bost has and that Bailey is going after, I think it was 56% voted mm-hmm. for Trump. So it's Trump land.
Yeah.
And this upends him. It's enough to, you know, legitimately, you know, bring his candidacy into question. Not only that, but it might also end his political career.
It's a big blow.
It's absolutely a big blow. It could cause him to lose this election.
Let's hit on one more congressional race before we take a quick break, Dave. What is happening with Republican incumbent Bill Foster?
Yeah, I mean, I just profiled that race this past week. And, you know, Foster, as is the case with other congressional Democratic incumbents in Illinois, is facing a primary. He's going up against an immigration lawyer named Qasem Rashid. Rashid is trying to go after Foster on not being willing to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. He says that Foster is beholden to business interests. But, you know, it doesn't seem as if Foster has a whole lot to worry about. He's run this district most of it for about 8 terms. Mm-hmm. And he's not on anybody's radar in terms of the congressional handicapping groups that we often turn to see which races are hot and which ones are not. So Foster is in pretty good shape. And then whoever wins that primary is going to go up against, you know, one of three Republicans who are running in that primary: Susan Hathaway Altman, Jerry Evans, and Kent Mercado.
What suburbs fall in that district?
It covers virtually every piece of the collar counties. It goes from, you know, down in Will County all the way up to Belvidere. And, you know, the thing about Foster, I mean, Belvidere was not part of his former congressional district because it got redrawn with the remap here a couple years ago. But when the Belvidere auto plant was shut down, Foster sprung into action and helped, along with Pritzker and others, to really bore in on President Biden and the United Auto Workers and the automakers to reopen this plant, and they did. So, I mean, that's something that you know, it's a big feather in Foster's camp that happened.
Now, as we talked about earlier, Illinois lawmakers were in Springfield this week. Well, so was White Sox owner Jerry Reinsdorf. What was he doing in the state capitol, Justin?
Well, according to him, he was just going there and talking and not talking specifics and kind of meet and greeting and walking around with a very cool leather jacket. But, I mean, I think we all know he was there because the Sox want a stadium in the South Loop at the 78 property that's been vacant for decades. You know, our reporting is that he is seeking like roughly $1 billion for the stadium itself. And then there's another hundreds of millions of dollars in previously approved TIF district that we talked about before, TIFs, that would pay for infrastructure around the stadium and around that larger site to kind of connect it to the rest of the city and unlock its potential. This deal would be paid by an existing 2% hotel tax on city hotel stays, which he would argue it, and the team is trying to argue, oh, that doesn't affect residents, right? Those are those out-of-towners coming in, and we're taking their money. Mm. And then it would be backed by a second layer. It would be kind of like a sales tax overlay district is how I referred to it. I think it could be called a sales TIF, and that is the state's portion of sales taxes in this 78 development. So as it gets built up and sales tax start getting generated, they would be set aside and used to back this new debt to pay for this new stadium. So that's something obviously the state would have to approve. He's down there speaking to, I believe he spoke to the Four Tops, right?
Mm-hmm. The legislative leaders.
Yeah, the legislative leaders.
The Four Tops.
Yes.
Please tell us more. Brandon and I are looking at each other like, these are not the Four Tops. I promise. We know the Four Tops. Not the Four Tops.
Some Four Tops.
So these are, yeah, the Democratic, you know, the state Senate president, the House speaker, and then their counterparts on the Republican side, the minority leaders. Specifically, he has not spoken with Governor J.B. Pritzker, who's been dismissive of this. He said he's not really in favor of subsidies for privately owned stadiums, but he is specifically not, you know, I think he probably could have killed this if he had said, absolutely never, we're never doing this. Mm-hmm. And he has not done that, and that's opened up the door for lobbying and speculation and continued discussions. But they have not met yet, so I am sure Jerry Reinsdorf would like to schedule that soon.
I'm just here excited that I got you to talk about TIFs twice in one recap. What kind of reaction do you think Reinsdorf's getting from downstate leaders?
Well, I mean, I think it's uniform. I don't think that there is great enthusiasm for this right now because people are sort rightfully scratching their heads here because Guaranteed Rate Field, which was built, you know, on the backs of taxpayers in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the bonds for that still haven't been paid off. And, you know, while the concepts and the renderings of this new stadium that he's talking about are beautiful and everybody can kind of see a need for how, you know, that, you know, dressing up the South Loop that way, there is a lot of appeal to that.
Yeah.
I think it's counterbalanced with the idea that, you know, this is a sports franchise that over four decades has won one championship. And the way that it's been run on his watch has left a lot of animosity. People just, I think largely, though, it's just a question of the public financing piece of this.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about a billionaire sports owner, interested in the legacy, obviously. He's as Justin pointed out, you know, I think it's significant that, you know, the governor has not publicly given him much hope here that he's on board. I mean, you have really one billionaire in our governor versus another billionaire, and I
That's
think
right.
those
battle
discussions
of
battle of billionaires, and you just have to think that Pritzker can kind of understand the underpinnings, the economic underpinnings of what it is that Reinsdorf is trying to accomplish here. And of course, part of that is to enhance the value of this sports franchise.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, is it right for taxpayers to be helping doing that?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I also wonder if there's just a bit of fatigue, like from, you know, us lay people who, you know, whether or not you're a fan of the White Sox or the Bears or whatever, like, really, do all of you really need brand spanking new facilities to play your games? And I get, you know, part of the argument, right, especially like, you know, for Bears fans who would love to be able to host a Super Bowl and to have a venue that is more modern. There's a lot more allowed. But like, I guess just as I'm a fan of sports, but not a big fan of sports.
Yeah.
Is there a little bit of fatigue from folks who are just like, this is like, a lot.
Can't you just
y'all.
Use what you have?
What's wrong with the one you have?
What's wrong with the one you have?
And don't forget, too, that, you know, we're talking about a new, I don't know what it even would be called, Comiskey 3, Guaranteed Rate 2, whatever it would be called.
2.0.
I mean, you have lurking out there this whole question about, and I presume we'll talk about this later, but the issue with the Chicago Bears, because if there's just a crack in the door open for the White Sox, yeah, you can guarantee that the McCaskey family is going to be knocking on the state's door
absolutely
as well.
Absolutely. Let's get to that
one
now.
One last thing. Sorry, just like what of the space that you were leaving, right? Is mm-hmm. it an opportunity for something new and amazing to come there? Maybe, but we don't know what that is yet. Or is it a future empty lot? And that is my concern, especially with existing guaranteed rate field, right? Is anybody else banging down the door to put something there? I don't know what it might be, a housing development, an office building.
I haven't heard of,
but yeah, does it just become something that is left empty?
I mean, if anybody's been driven through the middle of Atlanta, it's an interesting experience because on the south side of Atlanta is old Turner Field where the Atlanta Braves used to play, and it's still sitting there with no use,
yeah,
no real big use.
Yeah,
that's the same thing that would happen
here. The idea that the White Sox are floating, and I'm stressing idea because it's not a plan and there's no, while they have financials behind their move, they don't have financials behind guaranteed rate is, oh, you know, you could build up those parking lots that have sat vacant for decades, giving revenue to the team, and build those up, and maybe the Chicago Fire or another tenant could come in and renovate guaranteed rate, which
right,
I would imagine would also tap into the same payment structure that the new stadium would be built or paid for. So, you know, but that's all an idea. That is not a plan, and that it doesn't really.
Yeah,
we'll have to hear more later to see if the Fire themselves are.
And just real quickly, another point here that you know, in the late '80s when Reinsdorf was in Springfield to try to make this case for a stadium, he was threatening, of course, to move the team to St. Petersburg, Florida, and that was leverage. And now that he's doing that with Nashville, I think that's also set people off a little bit here too. It's like, you know, come on.
And you've mentioned the Bears a few times. I want to have Justin fill us in on what's going on with their taxes because they've got some bad news.
Yeah, so, you know, they have purchased, you know, about $200 million worth of pieces of land in Arlington Heights to potentially build a stadium there. And they've been kind of at odds with Cook County Assessor Fritz Keggy, who assessed that property at $192 million. Mm-hmm. And then the school districts that would receive a lot of that tax revenue. The school district and the Bears, they were about $100 million off in their assessments. The school districts were at $160 million. The Bears said, no, it's really worth $60 million. Remember, we demolished the old racetrack there. It's vacant land. And what appears to be happening, it's not finalized, is the Cook County Board of Review, who kind of is, you know, maybe an appeals process, so the first layer of appeals for these assessments. They appear to have reached a decision to be put that price tag at $125 million. So, like,
yeah,
slightly favoring the school districts. There was another, one commissioner had a little higher valuation, I think $147 million. You know, this would be, and then there's another important aspect of this is they, while they were giving them a lower assessment than what the assessor gave them, they are not kind of giving in to the Bears' ask that it be assessed as a vacant property. It would still be assessed at the 25% commercial rate rather than the 10% vacant rate. So that obviously will cause them to pay more in taxes.
This Bears Stadium saga. Too bad I don't have the time to talk about it, but I do want to talk about one more Bears story, Brandis, while you're here. The team's hired their first female coach in its history. What do we know about Jennifer King?
One Bears story I feel like I can talk about.
So, go.
I've got 30 seconds.
Jennifer, no, you got
King,
a whole minute.
A whole minute. She's 39 years old. She is the first female coach in the Bears history, but, you know, she's also history-making because she's the first full-time Black female coach in the NFL's history. And she has experience having played professional tackle women's football, as well as having worked with as an assistant running backs coach full-time for the Washington Commanders for some time. So she's gotten hired in that role, that same role for the Bears. So that is exciting. I'm looking for. And she's one of, I think, 13, currently 12 women who are full-time coaching for 9 NFL teams.
Yeah. Timing good on this, Dave? What do you think?
Well, I think it is. I mean, you know, of course, these teams need to look like us, and that's an important thing here. And I think it's long in coming.
Yeah.
You know, bigger question for the franchise beyond the stadium is who's going to quarterback the team next year?
Oh, Justin Fields, poor guy.
I've been seeing the Instagram posts.
He's quit following.
He turned it off.
He turned the, yeah, he stopped following him. But he said that he doesn't mean anything. That doesn't, you know.
Shouldn't, I think he just didn't want to hear the speculation.
Shouldn't, and I am not a Bears fan. I'm from Cincinnati. I'm loosely a Bengals fan. But shouldn't they not decide between the current quarterback and the future quarterback and just select the first quarter or the first pick as a quarterback, keep this current quarterback and just
that
hope
would just
and pray
be too
that
logical.
One of them is good. You
stop
know?
Coming in here and making sense.
Stop trying to decide.
What's wrong with you?
You need to just have all options on the table. You know?
All right, we'll leave it there. That's it for this week's Weekly News Recap. That's Justin Lawrence of Crane Chicago Business, Brandis Friedman of WTTW, and Dave McKinney of WBEZ. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If you're still listening, that means you really cannot get enough of Reset. Well, as your host, I salute you. It also seems to me that you might be a great candidate to receive Reset's daily newsletter. Every weekday at 10, we offer news explainers, Chicago culture, and recommendations on things to do around the city and region. You can sign up for that at wbez.org/resetnews. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.